Can you talk a little about the Uniform Assistance Relocation Act and Spencer's challenges?
Sure. So anytime you're using HUD money, especially, and you have a tenant in a structure and you're going to move them because of your project, the Uniform Relocation Assistance Act requires you to assist them in that process. So you have to make sure that they have some place to go. You have to make sure that that's comparable, and you may actually be paying for changes in the moving expense and then changes in rent. And so that can get relatively expensive for a while, depending upon things. And so you always have to be mindful of that whenever dealing with federal funds. We only had it on one property in Vermont, even though some of the properties had been rentals, but they were destroyed to the point that nobody was living in them at the time of purchase, which was way down the road.
All right. Could you talk a little bit more about the benefit of channel storage, room for the floodplain? And someone specifically is asking about capital B, capital C, capital A, BCA. And I'm not familiar with that abbreviation, or it's not quite an acronym.
So Lauren, you want to take that one?
Sure. I am familiar with the BCA acronym. It stands for Benefit Cost Analysis. Usually through FEMA's grant programs, you have to, if you are to try to access mitigation funds, you have to prove that the project for which you are requesting funds is cost effective, or that the benefits of the project either equal or outweigh the costs. Prior to 2012, I think it was, doing BCAs for buyouts was much more difficult. You would have to document past damages through this pretty antiquated system, a software tool that you can find on FEMA's website, and then put in the project budget, and it would have some back-end algorithm that would spit out a ratio and tell you whether or not your project is cost-effective. After doing a robust nationwide study of all buyouts, the costs, the benefits of them, FEMA released a memo saying, actually, it turns out, regardless of flood damage, if your structure is located within a floodplain and the total project costs associated with a buyout are $276,000 or fewer, you are immediately cost effective. And that changed the game for buyouts in Vermont. We were able to purchase, like we said before, 150 properties, almost all of which were able to fall under that pre-calculated benefit cost analysis memo or guidance. So that's, I would definitely recommend considering that also for larger, more expensive structures. You probably will have to do a benefit cost analysis unless you can demonstrate substantial damage and location within a floodplain. But again, floodplain, if you're located within it and the total project cost is 276 or less, your structure didn't even need to be damaged and you don't need to do a BCA.
Okay. Someone was asking whether buyouts ever happen before a hazard strikes. So I think that's an excellent question. Do people proactively, like in Fort Collins, I know they have a buyout program that they are pursuing. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, as Lauren mentioned, you can, using the FEMA money, as long as you're in a mapped flood zone and the project is going to cost $276K or less, you can use the FEMA money. That's generally going to be 75% money, and so you're going to need to find that other part of it. However, it may be evident from the homeowner, for example, their flood insurance rates are going up a lot, and they're looking at the property saying, I can't hold on to this. 75% beats trying to pay flood insurance forever on this thing. Or they may be looking at imminent damage, or just, you know, they've had some damage out there and just decided that they don't want to be there anymore. So yes, you can go in ahead of time with the FEMA funding, at least.
And is Vermont pursuing any properties that are, you know, vulnerable that haven't been damaged yet?
Yeah, we're actually... Yeah.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Lauren, So Lauren and I are working on a kind of a permanent statewide program to do this and start identifying those structures. Because as you can imagine, the only reason there weren't more is because the rain didn't fall in more places. And there are places that we can use GIS mapping and other tools to identify to and know that these structures will fail during an event, and go in and might as well get those out before, you know, your house looks like that one did in Rochester where it's tipped into the stream and all your possessions are strewn about.
So someone was asking how long, you mentioned it could be 2 years to get to closing. How quickly have you been able to get to closing? And I was also wondering, in the meantime, what do people do to organize their lives? Are they rent? How do they find housing? Are they renting somewhere? And then are they also having to pay a mortgage on a damaged property? How do people get through the transition between the hazard, the event, and getting to closing? And how quickly can you get to closing?
I don't know, Lauren, how fast did we ever do one?
Well, there are two primary obstacles, probably. One is the waiting game to actually receive the federal funding. Once you receive that, theoretically can go as quickly as 10 weeks to get to closing table. I think, Kevin, we might have done a handful. We were able to do it within 3 months to actually get the funding to the homeowners. That said, just like those wrinkles we mentioned before, if there's any reason that we can't establish clear title through a title search, strange easements that we've seen across the state dating back to the early 1700s or 1800s have actually caused us several months worth of delay in getting those extinguished. So it really depends. It's a case by case. Quickest would be 3 months from the date of award to closing, I think. And longest, again, like we said, has been years.
Okay. Do you have, is there any reason someone wouldn't be able to take advantage of these programs if their property is a second home?
Well, we weren't limited on that, no.
Okay.
You had another part of that first question, which had to do with kind of what are people doing in the meantime?
Oh, yeah, the transition, yes.
And so that's where your social service agencies, Red Cross, church groups, any other peoples are helping those folks get on with their lives because they can't be back in that house usually. So that's a big issue. Most of the banks, by far, were very willing to forego mortgage payments waiting for the buyout because they understood this person's life is kind of gone to hell anyways. Most of the towns abated the taxes, so your property taxes due. Some of these places actually had their property tax due the next day, the way property tax works and in Vermont. And obviously they're not going to pay it, so the towns were able to say, listen, you know, we're just going to abate that. Don't worry about it for now. So if you have local banks or other folks, you can try to get through some of that. We are suggesting that the state consider basically a loan program because, again, 3 months is the fastest you're going to get the money after you get an award from FEMA. So there's a couple months in there at least. Meantime, you got to think about the next place. It probably makes sense for localities to have a loan program where they loan the person a bunch of money, keep that person in the community, the person then goes finds the next property, and then at buyout time, that loan gets paid back. And so you end up not being out a lot of money.
Okay.
But that's ideas, kind of one of our ideas going forward.
So someone was asking about restrictions that might exist on the funds. Are these funds released for and only for the buyout of the property? In other words, is it put in some kind of escrow and managed by a lawyer so that you don't end up using the money to, say, improve your other property that's in another floodplain and create a bigger problem?
The short answer is no. It's even though it's a bit complicated, if you imagine a town applying on behalf of a homeowner to the federal government for funding that then comes back down to the town and passed to the homeowner. There's a lot moving there, but really at the heart of it, it's just a standard property transaction. So the homeowners through the program that we've done in Vermont were only paid at the closing table. So the town would write a check that they received from both Kevin and me. We wired over or sent a check to the town 10 days prior to closing, and then the check would transfer from town to property owner. So there's never really been a large issue of whether or not a $200,000 check went to a homeowner, and we were just hoping that they didn't do anything else with it. There are a couple of things that can or cannot be done, like a standard property transaction. Homeowners can't take out a bunch of fixtures and bring them with them. Generally, we didn't run into any serious issues, at least that I'm aware of. Kevin, if you know something, jump in.
No, with the same program, we did not do relocation. So sometimes you can actually move a structure. And in that case, you can't move it to within the floodplain as well and things like that. But we didn't deal with that here.
Have you ever had to address community cohesion? You mentioned several houses moving off that Channel Island, or you showed the picture of the bridge that was removed. Is there ever a sense that a community is being broken up and that they want to maintain some social cohesion?
Certainly. Well, in the media, we see larger sections where you're going to buy out an entire neighborhood or something. And we didn't have to deal with that scale. We did have two spots where we bought about 17 houses kind of right in a row. In those cases, there was enough left of the community around that people were fine with it, or the damage was so severe that people also, it was evident to everybody there nobody should be living in this thing. People were very lucky not to be killed during this event.
So someone was asking, this is sort of a follow-up from two questions ago. Often, places that experience flooding are in locations where some populations of people have been priced out of the local market for housing. And so are there companion efforts, and you mentioned social services agencies, but are there companion efforts to help identify affordable housing for people who have been impacted by a major flood event?
Lauren, you want to talk about that, or? We were talking about this yesterday a little bit.
We were. So there's obviously in Vermont, a rural place, there is kind of a constant state of concern for affordable housing and just housing in general. There just aren't that many structures for a somewhat growing population. We didn't have, following Irene, when we purchased all these properties, there was no formal program or sub-program, I should say, that was assisting these homeowners after property transfer to the town to help them find a location within the state or within the same town. And we didn't really do much follow-up because there were so many properties and so many families and so many towns that it was kind of a very transactional, let's get the paperwork done, let's make sure that the homeowners are paid as quickly as possible so that they can move on with their lives. But there was never a formal follow-up with them or intentional effort to keep them in the location that they were being moved out of, inadvertently or otherwise. There are towns that were very concerned following Irene when we approached them if they were interested in participating in the buyout program, that they would be losing not only their residents and part of their community and their community aesthetic, especially in our historic areas, but also a concern over the loss of their tax base. For smaller towns, even just losing two or three structures can have a significant impact on that grand list value. So we had to also try to work around that. So not only are the homeowners concerned that the community that they grew up in their whole lives, they can't find another property, but also that towns are concerned that their they're going to permanently lose this tax revenue.
Yeah, and so some of that is a major planning discussion. So if you're a land use planner like me, and especially if you are on the coast, where your flood risk is just going to increase and increase until a lot of the land isn't there anymore, or if you're on some of these rivers where the risk is very known. To me, that's one of those basic land use planning discussions that's helpful to have early on going, oh, we should build less over here, but we still want people. Where are we going to put them? We should build more over here. And thinking about that overall from the community level. Even if it's just in advance of a flood, and so that when the flood hits, you know, oh, we thought about moving all of those people and we're able to put them over here.
So have you dealt in neighborhood buyouts? Have you come across a situation where you need to convince a holdout sort of to maximize the benefit or even to get the benefit? You mentioned, for instance, lowering a floodplain to increase storage during flood events. So if you had a holdout, that would be difficult. Have you come across that problem?
The two spots would be Northfield and Stockbridge. In the Northfield example, we did not end up with a house kind of right in the middle. We end up with a couple near the edge that probably should have been bought, but we were able to build a sizable park. In Stockbridge, we did have a couple that stayed within there. However, sometimes people think, oh, I'm going to stay, and then you explain flood regulations to them and say, oh, by the way, your house has substantial damage. You're going to be jacking it 4 feet in the air, just so you know it's not ripping out the drywall. It's $40,000 of foundation work. And then sometimes they go, oh, I didn't compute that before. A buyout sounds like a good idea. So have your code enforcement folks also in hand and understand what local flood regulations are really going to mean early on in terms of rebuilding before they start swinging the hammers.
Yeah. And as a follow-up to that, the relationship that you can make with a town and those property owners is really invaluable. The more they can trust you, that you're there to do good, not only by them, but also by the town and the residents who are staying, it cannot be understated. We have one town where there are more than 220 structures located within the MAP floodplain. It would be pretty difficult to buy all of those out, and it would devastate the town and the economy and all of the history that's there. But we identified a parcel downstream that's undeveloped, that if we could just excavate that property, again, undeveloped, it's just a piece of land right now against the river, it's causing a choke point, backfilling that town with 220 structures. If you can make the connection with that property owner, which is what we've been trying to do now for quite some time, if we get that project done, then we can reduce flood levels in that village by 1 to 2 feet. So that's pretty significant, but it's because these programs are completely voluntary, not only for the town, but also for the property owners, you have to get them on board. And it's not always easy, and sometimes you don't. And when you don't, it's kind of heartbreaking.
Have you installed any, I'm sorry, we're just bouncing around these questions a little bit. The subjects are bouncing around because this is what people are offering. So I apologize if we're just throwing different ideas at you, but someone is interested in sort of the stormwater engineering side of have any projects resulted in stormwater retention basins or ponds or temporary storage?
I'll speak, and Lauren, maybe you could think about Barry because you may know that more. For down here, they have resulted in what we call a flood bench. And so it's not river. Some of these properties are literally river now, and so the river's going to stay there. Other properties, you're able to take out the house, and then you take out the foundation. And either they had put historical fill in and moved the river over, or while we're doing the work, we can take out some more material and give the river basically a mini floodplain so it can remove some of its energy. In Vermont, we have ice jams. probably have one tomorrow. And those ice jams, it's very good if you have a little spot for the ice to get up and get pushed out, not into a neighbor's yard, but just on one of these little benches. It can really kind of help everything be much better. So Lauren, and you want to talk about Barry at all?
Sure. So actually a few slides back, Kevin went over a picture where there was once a bridge and it looked relatively densely populated. That's from Barry City. Let's see, we're going back. Oh, that's the one. So there was a bridge there, the bluish gray house, the house immediately next to it's kind of pale yellow, two white houses in the background, and then another house that you can't see. All five of those were all purchased. This is in Barry City. It's densely populated. There isn't much space to create some sort of retention or water pond. And right downstream of this picture is basically two right angles that the river has to make. This is the Gunner's Brook. If you can kind of see up in the middle-ish, you can see kind of piers popping up. After these properties were purchased, there was a little bit of floodplain restoration. We dropped down some of the land so that it could create some storage capacity, but the town also recognized that there's a lot of debris coming down this brook, and there's also quite a bit of ice jam issues, like Kevin just mentioned. So those are actually called trash racks, and they were put in and engineered that will catch large debris that keeps catching on downstream infrastructure, causing significant damage, not only to the roads, but acting as projectiles to downstream properties. So that was an engineered design plan that was part of this larger effort. There are actually, I think, 27 houses that's part of this bigger master plan that the city would like to slowly but surely remove. And if they can do that all in one area, which they're trying to do, then they can actually create better flood retention. So this is kind of phase one of a much larger effort in the city.
How do you determine the value of a property? How do you negotiate the value of a property? How is that done?
Well, the nice thing is we don't have to negotiate it, which is good. We just use the appraisal of the property. So the towns hire an appraiser and they go out and they appraise it. If the owner doesn't like that, they hire their own appraiser. And then if those things don't agree, then there's a third appraiser that comes in. But we pay the appraised value. We don't kind of dicker around with things.
Great. This is probably a question for Lauren. Can you talk about how this work ties in with hazard mitigation planning?
Oh, sure. And Kevin can speak to it too, since he's helped with several in his region. So hazard mitigation plans are required for any jurisdiction, be it a town or a state, to access these FEMA funds. The best part about that, not only getting to access it, is that it actually provides an opportunity every 5 years for a town to sit down with the appropriate staff, residents, community members, business owners, et cetera, to talk about the hazards, the natural hazards that affect their jurisdiction. In Vermont, almost every single town's number one issue is flooding, whether it's inundation or fluvial erosion. And so you identify those hazards, you identify vulnerabilities to them, and then you also identify certain mitigation actions you can take to reduce your vulnerability. Like we said at the very beginning, the reason you should do buyouts is because it's a permanent fix. You completely remove the vulnerability. And we have a lot of towns that have identified certain areas of towns, even certain structures that they're aiming to eventually go after and buy out. Or again, do those nature-based solutions like floodplain restoration. If those are captured in local mitigation plans, they also get a small bump by the state review committee who looks at these applications, and they say, wow, the town's already been thinking about this. They're being proactive. They've identified the structure. There's now funding available and they're going after it. We give them more points than a town that hasn't necessarily considered it. So definitely reach out to your town or your city or your county if you're in a state that has functioning counties, and access your mitigation plan. Again, it's every 5 years. There's a lot of good information in them.
And I should mention the work Lauren does, which is on the state mitigation plan. So, you know, you don't have to start from square one. Oftentimes your state mitigation plan can give you a bunch of the core information you could use at the town level. in Vermont, flooding is our number one hazard. The number one issue about dealing with that is to institute some buyouts.
Okay. We're not going to get through all these questions, but we'll just get through as many as we can. Have you seen buyouts applied to erosion hazards, not flooding per se?
In Vermont, most of our flood damage is actually an erosional hazard. And so the river has moved sideways and gone underneath the house. And that led to a bunch of our houses literally not being there, and they're just being flood channeled where the flood was. For those of you who deal with FEMA, the flood map isn't going to change. And so even though the river is no longer where the flood map shows it is, the flood map is going to keep showing the river there. And that's just one thing you're just going to have to deal with FEMA about. That's been a major issue is lateral erosion. As the rivers really try to regain that sinuosity that they had before we stuck a bunch of walls and bridges in their way.
Right. Well, that's a good. Go ahead, Lauren.
There's also an opportunity for landslide buyouts. So we, after Irene, had several homes that were way up, way, way, way out of a floodplain, sometimes 70 or 100 feet above the river. But as the river rose and cut into slopes, significant landslides started to form or slopes started to fail. We were able to, I think, purchase between 5 or 10 properties that had no flood damage, weren't in the mapped floodplain at all, through the FEMA landslide benefit cost analysis tool, which really only requires you to determine building replacement value and have your state geologist or just a geologist come out to the site and determine imminent threat status, which is essentially that structure is at imminent threat of a landslide failure within 5 years. So consider that as well for states that have landslide issues or significant erosion but are not in a mapped floodplain. We've been doing that quite a bit too.
Right, yeah. And as you mentioned, people may have more questions than we have time for. Lauren and my contact information by email is on there, and certainly feel free to follow up with us.
Yeah, and what we'll do is we'll have a back and forth where we collect the questions that we weren't able to address in the webinar today and attempt to put that together some answers. In fact, if the speakers would stay on the phone at the end of the call, we can discuss that. But just as a follow-up to the previous point, could you speak a little bit to restoring the actual function of the floodplain? So you all mentioned channelized streams. And, you know, the floodplain serves a lot of functions, allowing a river to spread out and slow down, for instance. So can you talk about some of the design, engineering, and even social challenges of restoring some of those natural functions to areas adjacent to rivers that should be really functional floodplains?
Well, I'll start, and then Laura. Vermont is very cognizant of natural river functions on the state level and on the permitting level. And so the idea of kind of fighting a river or putting it back where it was, or all of those slightly macho concepts is not widely shared, certainly not within government circles, because the physics of it are that every time you do that, you give somebody else a problem. So every time you berm, you push the river back, whatever, all you're doing is taking that water and energy and sending it somewhere else. And that's a good framing around it, because a lot of people want to kind of control nature. They don't want to be beaten by it or something. And instead to reframe it as, why are you giving your neighbor a problem? Don't give your neighbor a problem. Be responsible. And so that's kind of the moral, social thinking around those things. As far as the physics around it, basically rivers want to move. It's why if you let go of a hose, it wiggles around. That's their most natural state. And anytime you squeeze them, the rest of it's going to want to move more So sometimes you're not giving it much more storage, but you're giving it sinuosity. And that's really going to help. That river's going to able to deposit sediment there. It's going to, you know, get out its kind of its craziness without taking out the next structure down. Lauren, you want to go on some more stuff?
No, that was good.
So someone asked, what is HUD?
Oh,
and you can make your question answers very brief because we have at least 20 questions here.
So that's U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Okay. How, so this question, I didn't quite know how to phrase it. How periodic remodeling of rivers and water channels can reduce damages? I guess someone's asking about ecological engineering, essentially.
Oh, you mean like actual river shaping?
Yeah.
Basically, from a sinuosity point of view, every time you push it back, it's going to push back typically on the opposite side of the river, four times the river's width. So there is no free lunch. So every time you give them some room, somebody else is going to get saved in the next one.
Okay. Are buyout participants required to move out of a floodplain when they relocate?
No, we don't. Oh. We don't really. It's just like you're buying the house. We don't tell them where they have to go. We do suggest that if people were to think about this loan program where you make public loan money available, then maybe you work with that and actually get people to the next place, trying to keep them in your community, but in a safe spot.
Several people asked about whether you do track whether people stay in the community or even in the state. Is there any follow-up or understanding of the impacts to local economies or state economies from these buyouts?
We don't do any formal tracking, just anecdotally. Some of the homeowners that Kevin or me or the towns have stayed in touch with, do we know where they are? But it would have been nice in hindsight to have done some sort of formal tracking for that, if possible.
Oh, that'd be a great thing to be looking at.
Yeah, frontier for research there.
And not only what do they do, but how could you, what would it take to keep them around?
Right.
Right.
Someone mentioned that this was the first time they'd heard about National Flood Insurance Program, ICC, being used for demolition. Can you say a bit more about how that works? And do you have to have an approved HMGP or CDGB buyout to use ICC funding in this way?
I will answer it as best I can, though I know just enough to be dangerous. We haven't in Vermont actually had to have any of our homeowners go this route just yet because we had all of that federal aid from different sources and state aid. We were able to do that 100% match, so we didn't need for homeowners to go out and do that. For those property owners that are not going to be so fortunate to receive 100% funding, if they have a flood insurance policy, they can communicate with their policy holder and request those increased cost of compliance funds that can be used often to help with structural elevations, which is, I think, when most property owners or policy holders try to access those funds. So in the event of a substantial damage or a proactive homeowner who wants to bring their structure into compliance with NFIP, especially as NFIP policies and compliance continue to change, there's this pot of funding, ICC, up to $30,000 that they can use either for elevation or in the event of a buyout where there isn't match, they can access it for match for the HMGP grant.
Great answer.
Beyond that, I would definitely say talk to your state flood NFIP coordinator or floodplain manager because they should know more than I do.
Great. So someone pointed out the recent reporting on how disaster recovery dollars from FEMA and buyouts in particular are disproportionately going to wealthy people who are the owners of property. And so this person is asking about renters and people who are not in a financial position to own property, you know, essentially saying the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Does equity factor into your program at all? And if so, how do you address it? And if not, that's fine. But they were asking about that.
Well, I mean, some of it's just the physics of the thing. You can't buy the house if they don't own the house. You're buying the house from the owner. In our particular case, especially because we had HUD funding, the HUD CDBG Community Development Block Grant money wants to benefit low and moderate income people. So we know, because we tracked it, that basically half of the people whose homes were bought have incomes 80% or below the county median. And so that's, so a lot of lower income folks' homes were bought in this program. One of the places that is a difficult nut to crack is buying mobile homes that are typically owned by the owner but sit on a rented lot in a mobile home park. You can't do a buyout there because they don't own the land, they just own the structure. And that's one of those things that's going to need some policy and probably statutory revisions to try to be able to deal with that particular place. So you can buy the structure, but then have them go to a different spot.
Got it. So this person was a first responder for Sandy in the Far Rockaways on Long Island, and wanted to know how can there be a buyout when the property was challenged by toxins, as many basins were during Sandy?
Was challenged by what?
I think this person was saying that there were toxins in the basements, and I'm not sure specifically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so that's when the CDBG money comes in. FEMA will not buy a property they consider contaminated. They will do what we call a phase one environmental assessment, which basically says, could this be contaminated or not? But we had a lot of oil tanks overturned. Happens in Vermont. We have burned a lot of oil. Your basement floods, the oil tank floats up, turns over, spills all the oil, that type of thing. EPA sometimes does hazardous material removal immediately after a flood. But if you're contaminated, we bought an insulation company, for example, whose building was destroyed, needed to be remediated. That's where the Community Development Block Grant disaster recovery money, which is special money that comes from Congress, that only came after certain disasters. That's not a standing program. However, Community Development Block Grant money is a standing program, and if states chose to use it, they could use some of that money for that. I should mention that EPA monies might also be available to do either assessment or clean of a property, and then giving them back into the FEMA program and doing it. So it's not impossible, it's just not easy. For those of people who want to do that, I would urge them to also talk to Vermont's site management section, which is what deals with brownfields in Vermont, because we had to do a lot of going around with FEMA, because FEMA's understanding of clean was not HUD's understanding of clean. And we were able to develop a letter from the state that FEMA accepts that says this site has been cleaned to all state and federal standards. Because in brownfields work, you very rarely make anything clean. You just make them clean enough to meet the standards. And that sometimes it was lost on FEMA, but we developed a way to deal with that.
Excellent. This person's asking about opportunities that Irene may have opened up around to approach property owners, and it's wondering about PDM SMA funding as a potential source, and what about other partners such as state funds, conservation groups, et cetera, for helping with buyouts?
Well, that's a twofold answer, I guess. In the immediate aftermath of Irene, we were obviously much more empowered or emboldened. Towns were to go out to homeowners to, one, check in on how they were doing both structurally and emotionally following an event, and then, two, open up the opportunity to say, hi, the state and Kevin have come out and said, we have some funding. We can potentially help you out of this. Again, it's going to take several years maybe, but if you're interested, this might be your best way. So it did definitely open communication lines that weren't otherwise there. It would have been great, obviously, to have those types of conversations pre-Irene in a more proactive way, which is one of the lessons that we've learned, where we can go out now and say, we know that house was only partially damaged in Irene, or the river got kind of close. Let's go tell this story and see if they're interested. As far as PDM and FMA following Irene, we actually, as a state, didn't really go after those funds because we had so much hazard mitigation grant program funding. And that HMGP funding is tied specifically to the disaster, and you have a short period that you can actually apply under it. So we, instead of going after the much more competitive PDM and FMA funding, which is an annual grant program not tied to a disaster, every single state and tribe can apply for it. State of Vermont focused on that HMGP funding, which is much less competitive, set aside to the state, but is time bound. So we didn't, we kind of just ignored PDM and FMA for a couple of years, but now as our HMGP funds are starting to dry up and we're getting these smaller disasters annually, we're starting to go now for PDM FMA more. And we've been still applying every year for probably 5 to 10 buyouts through both HMGP and PDM FMA.
And I don't know if we already said it, but HMGP is Hazard Mitigation Grant Program under FEMA. PDM is pre-disaster mitigation. FMA is flood mitigation assistance.
That's helpful to me. Thank you. How sustainable is FEMA and HUD funding in the face of predicted widespread sea level rise along the coasts in the 21st century? And how can communities prepare for possibly funds not being available?
This is a good question. There's a lot of talk that FEMA is going to raise its disaster threshold, and which is probably a good idea. It'll put more onus on towns to not have disasters in the first place. I'm sure, like any other thing that has consequences in life, people will squirm about that, but they're talking about doing that. And then there's talk about then creating a deductible, basically, so towns that have spent a bunch of money making a bigger bridge or doing something will then be able to count that against that higher disaster threshold. That's one thing. The other thing is, we're obviously not going to buy out 10,000 structures in Vermont or everything on the East Coast, because the dollar figure is way too high. The best thing to me there is, don't build anything more. Don't dig your hole deeper is the first step. And we are certainly seeing around the nation, and I understand there are local political reasons supporting that, but we're seeing people construct new structures that will not last the life of that. Nobody in their right mind thinks that structure is going to last its structural lifetime. It will be underwater. It'll be in the ocean. And by the way, we're not going to charge you for polluting the ocean because your house went in the ocean or your apartment went in the ocean. So don't keep doing the stupid stuff. For the people that are already there, that's to me where what communities planners do is, that's a community discussion. What do we want to do? Do we want to fight as long as we can? Do we want an orderly retreat? Do we want to literally drag these things back 100 feet maybe and put them in a better spot? Are there structures we can salvage? Is there one particular part we're going to protect and the rest we're not going to protect? And how do we be equitable in that? All of those things can get played out via a community discussion, which people like me like, although they're going to be contentious, they're going to be hot, or they can get played out on the one-by-one personal tragedy where just some win and some lose, and it's just up to the luck of the draw. But it ain't gonna be pretty.
All right. We still got quite a ways to go, so I'll encourage you to be brief. And I also wanted to just check in. It's 1:30 Can we, do you have time to continue?
I have about a half hour. Yeah.
Okay. So I think if we plug away, we can do this, but I mean, maybe aim for a minute per question at most, because there's quite a few here. How do you convince a town to engage in this process? I can imagine some towns are wary to pursue this due to lack of their own administrative capacity and tight budget.
We tell them, yeah, we tell them there's 100% money for all the costs, and there's a little bit of money for their costs.
And we will hold your hands as much as possible along the way.
Have you been able to determine if buyout property owners are relocating back in another location within the town? We already discussed this,
yeah,
so we'll move on. The $276,000 is the property cost, not the overall project. Multiple properties just have to have an average value of less than that amount. In the Midwest, we rarely do HMGP acquisition directly post-DR, mostly pre-event.
So the 276 is total project cost.
It's total project cost, yeah.
Yeah, so it does have to include the appraisal, the legal fees, the actual purchase of the property, and the demolition. But that said, you can apply in bulk. So if you have one single application where the average per property is 276 or lower for total project cost, you can apply. So we were fortunate for a couple of those properties where we bought out five or six per, we could have a much more expensive property or parcel get thrown in and let those lower property values kind of make that average work for us. So if you're doing this in a planning sense and you recognize, well, there's a $300,000 property, we would need, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 extra just to do the full buyout for it. It's not going to work. We have to do a BCA. Recommend looking at neighboring properties that might be lower value, batch them and go forward.
Mm-hmm. We should also mention very briefly, sometimes structures aren't in any MAP flood zone and there's no MAP flood zone there. And then there's something called 5% initiative within HMGP to look at.
So there's a two-part question here. But I didn't hear what you said. Sorry.
The 5% initiative that Kevin just mentioned does not require a benefit cost analysis either. It just requires a narrative statement for why the project is cost effective. So we were able to purchase, I think, 15 or so houses under the 5% initiative, for which we couldn't determine cost effectiveness because it wasn't in the floodplain.
Okay. This is a two-part question, but you already answered the question about whether, you know, more expensive property, so I'm going to skip that part of the question. How does one begin the planning process for buyout? Specifically, how do I help my coastal town and local funding organization get organized and ready to pursue buyouts?
I would say that you would have that discussion pretty much in writing your hazard mitigation plan is probably the best place to start.
I agree.
Excellent. These vulnerable properties that have been identified in flood zones are viable for buyout. Is this a state policy that allows this action? Also, do these established flood zones include climate change projections into the flood elevations?
They don't include climate change projections, I can tell you
that.
No,
they do not.
In fact, they don't even include current change projections. Most of ours are based on, you know, 1950s data and maps made in the 70s.
Right. There are a number of communities around the country who are developing their own rating curves and floodplain maps and essentially through their own ordinances driving the establishment of better stream gauge data for their local communities.
We highly encourage, if you're going to do flood regulations, to go above and beyond the FEMA stuff and add in a couple feet if you can.
Right. What about the state policy question? Is it state policy to pursue these buyouts?
It's not formalized anywhere. That said, it was identified in the 2018 State Hazard Mitigation Plan for Vermont as one of the top three mitigation strategies that the state should be going after. The plan itself was adopted by the governor's office. So though there's not a specific policy tied to it, the governor and his administration support that as one of our most significant efforts for mitigation in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Have you run into URA timelines conflicting with FEMA POP timelines?
Well, we just had the one structure where we dealt with URA, and I don't know. It's the
And could you define those terms? Because I'm not familiar.
Well, to try to be very brief, one of the issues with the URA is you have to tell somebody if you're going to be moving them within 90 days. So, you know, we're going to buy out the house. We're going to buy out the house within 90 days. Now you have to think about it. The nice thing about buyouts is they usually take 2 years. So oftentimes people have just moved on their own. It's only when you get close to the buyout that you actually are under the URA gun.
So URA is Unified Relocation Assistance, and POP is Period of Performance from FEMA. FEMA period of performance is typically 3 years, either for small events from the date of the declaration or the application closure, which is a year later. For larger events like Irene, we were able to push that back. I'll say that it is definitely dependent upon the regional office for FEMA. We're FEMA Region 1 in New England. You have to request extensions to your period of performance frequently, and as long as you can document a justifiable reason for why you have not been able to complete your scope within that 3 year period, they're usually pretty responsive to allowing a 6 month or 12 month extension, getting a tenant money that they probably deserve to move to a location that's either outside the floodplain or outside of a damaged structure is one of those cases that I'm sure FEMA would be lenient on.
Excellent. You noted that if flood insurance is available, people were not eligible as they had to use insurance. Is there work within the insurance industry to ensure that structures are either built back with better resilience or that they receive money from insurance but can't use it to rebuild there if it's a high hazard area?
I should probably clarify if I misspoke. So what we can't do is we can't double on top of insurance. So if you get $50,000 of flood insurance, and your house is worth $150,000, we're only going to pay you $100,000. You get to keep the $50,000, and we pay $100,000, so you get the $150,000. If you spent the flood insurance that you got trying to fix your house up, and some people did, you spent that $50,000 back on your house, and you have receipts for it, then we don't deduct that because it's come into your pocket and gone out. Now we pay you the full $150,000. So there's that. The second part of that question is really, what about trying to make people use their insurance payments to not re-stupid? And so that's really a case-by-case basis. There's places where it was a freak occurrence because the truck jammed under the bridge and you're not really going to get it again. There's other places where it's really stupid to put that money back in. But the owner has so much potential equity loss that they decide to do that versus any other route. I approach these things from a public safety point of view, which just says that's a rescue waiting to happen. Regardless of the personal finance issues out there, it's a rescue waiting.
As the state hazard mitigation officer, Lauren, do you act as the lead on buyout applications? How much assistance do you provide to communities to apply for and carry out the projects from start to finish, and who else has helped with that process?
So for the FEMA side, yes, I'm the lead. But again, we had our Bob for a while, and we have Kevin now, who are managing those matching grant programs, which is a hugely helpful piece of infrastructure that we set up in the state. But yes, for FEMA grant applications, I would recommend any town or homeowner to reach out to the state hazard mitigation officer and discuss potential opportunities for larger states. Vermont's the second smallest, obviously. It's just me and one mitigation planner. So it's two full-time staff that can be devoted to working on helping towns with mitigation applications. In larger states, they have a bigger staff. Because Vermont's so small, I know all of the towns and most of the people in them. So I and I'll speak for Kevin, too, do a lot of handholding with our towns to help mm-hmm. where we can, recognizing that a lot of the town offices are only open 3 days a week, or they are semi-retired town clerks who are trying to help their residents, but need a lot of assistance on the way. So,
yeah.
Yes, state has
we do a lot of driving.
Contact. We do a lot of driving.
Yeah. We drive to people's houses. We drive to night meetings. We drive to all over.
Here's a good hazard mitigation question. Why not shelter in place and wait for a buyout?
Oh, if that's safe to do, shelter in place is an emergency term where you don't leave, you don't evacuate. And so sheltering in place might be a good idea. It's not a good idea if you have no basement, if you have no furnace and winter's coming on, if black mold is taking over your structure, if there's no longer a bridge to get there. A bunch of the reasons why sheltering in place was not a good idea for us. There may be spots where you don't have any good options and the structure is still usable. That didn't mostly happen with us.
Though we did have several homeowners who did either who weren't insured through a flood insurance policy, or if they were, use their flood insurance claim to temporarily fix part of those things so that they'd pulled out their drywall and put it back in, knew that this money might come down the pipeline, but that they didn't have enough funding to live elsewhere. This was kind of putting a Band-Aid over the issue until that money came in. So we had a handful of homeowners who did that as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you kind of addressed this already, but so it can be brief, but what's your process for working with social services?
Boy, we were very lucky in Vermont. We had a case management system with our human service agency. And so they were in touch with the people, and they are able to get a bunch of personal information that we don't really want or need, and help those people on with their lives. There was also pro bono legal work separately. There was Red Cross separately. And in Vermont, through license plate sales and other stuff, we created something called the Vermont Disaster Relief Fund, which would give small grants up to $20,000 directly to contractors, not to people, for work around in people's houses. So that was another critical kind of piece for a bunch of small jobs.
And a lot of these services were really only available to us too, because it was such a large statewide disaster with so much aid and interest and attention, media, et cetera. So for those smaller localized events where it's just one town or even just two houses that are getting hit, it's still just as impactful to those homeowners as Irene was to all of the homeowners that it affected, but there's less of a social network. So the towns, they really need to be as proactive as they can be in offering assistance, but also church groups and a couple of different state agencies can offer assistance. But really, a lot of this was possible because of Irene.
Yeah.
You mentioned there's an opportunity for pre-buying with FEMA funds. Can they buy vacant lots to prevent future problems?
Oh, that's such a good question. Currently, just purchasing a lot, no. Though a lot of the states are trying to get them to change that policy, because that's really the best mitigation, is preventing any development in the first place. That said, we have been able to do buyouts of undeveloped lots where we intend to also do floodplain restoration. So if we're actually doing a project on site and not just purchasing empty space, then we've been able to we've kind of been able to do it that way, but that does require a benefit cost analysis. But I love that question. Kevin and I talk about it all the time.
Yeah, and we're actively working to change that, because that's more of a rule than a statute issue with FEMA. Yeah.
Someone was asking why people can't remove fixtures or perhaps other valuables from a home if it's under negotiation.
Because we're going back to that day before the flood and appraising that value, and it had the lights in it then. So you can remove anything that you would take with you during a regular house sale. So if you usually are taking, you know, the lamps and the sofa and whatever, all that stuff can go. You're not usually taking the doors and windows, so that stuff stays. If you want to take it, then you're going to have to value that and deduct all those things out there, which is going to be a nightmare. So,
okay. Do you run into buyouts from natural disasters other than flooding in this region, like ice jams or winter damage?
Well, I mean, we've got a couple ice jam buggers out there for sure.
Yeah, and the ice jams, I mean, the result of an ice jam is usually flooding. But I did mention earlier in the webinar those landslide purchases. We've done, again, between 5 and 10. So those can be accessed, and those are really easy to do because everyone's motivated, including FEMA, to move quickly because theoretically that structure is going to collapse at any moment.
Right, and it's way cheaper to demolish it before you have to go 100 feet down a bank and get it back out of the river.
Way cheaper, yep. And it's easy to convince a town to get on board to landslide buyout, especially because, again, if I'm the homeowner and my house just fell into the river, I'm not going to go pay to have some sort of demolition contractor go down and pull it all out for $50,000. So then a town would have to, unless they went through the town or state or some sort of government would need to do that. So this is the better approach.
Right. Plus the town worries about it after it falls in the river, then it sticks in their bridge.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Plugs up the river and floods more.
Do you think that climate change factors into any people's thinking about whether to participate in a buyout?
I don't know if it did. We have had a few buyouts where they flooded during Irene and they've flooded twice by the time we buy them out again. So, you know, some didn't get it the first time, and by the third flood, they're like, come on. But I think most people just saw that as an individual event versus on the policy side, we see it related to climate, but for the average homeowner, I'm not sure.
The average homeowner, I would agree with Kevin, but we have had a few who have probably undiagnosed, but from an armchair perspective, like PTSD from every time it rains, they check their local river gauge, they wonder if they have to evacuate, how long is the storm going to last, how many inches of rain is going to fall. We've had several of those homeowners who have, each time funding comes available, contact us to say, we didn't used to get storms as much and as frequent as, or as severe as we do now, and we want out, our house hasn't flooded. We're in the floodplain, though, and we don't want to live where we have this constant fear of rain. We've had a handful of those.
Thanks for that. What non-FEMA flood mapping resources do you recommend for site-specific planning?
Well, Vermont has its own special geomorphic analysis, which most states don't do. If you don't have a FEMA map, there may be an Army Corps map out there, which there are sometimes Army Corps inundation maps out there, or the towns themselves may have done special studies.
Okay. This is the last question. Do you have high hopes for the current discussion about a state revolving fund for pre-disaster mitigation, similar to the state drinking water, clean water revolving fund? And how would Vermont take advantage?
That's
we have high hopes.
So they may be talking about a national discussion versus a state discussion. I don't know on this question. I would hope that in Vermont we can see our way to a loan program where we're able to loan in anticipation of a buyout, and that will really help people get on with their lives. And probably we should tie that to some, you know, staying in Vermont or something. That would be nice. I don't know about any national mitigation. Do you, Lauren?
Yeah, I don't know either. Not a revolving fund, no. But that state increasing state funding or fund available following a disaster or pre disaster is something that new state buyout program that Kevin and I are going to run. We're trying to focus our efforts there too.
Well, thank you for the extra effort here. That was interesting that it was another 40 minutes worth of Q&A. People are interested in this subject, so thank you so much.
Sure.
I'm going to end the recording here. And
okay.
So I think we're all set, and you guys take care. We'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks. I look forward to looking at that spring outlook stuff.
Oh, cool. All right. Check it out.